to be a lawyer just like you.
You're out of order.
Good for you, son.
The whole trial is out of order.
If there's one thing America needs,
they're out of order.
It's more lawyers.
Oh. You got my pride hanging out of my bed.
Welcome to Legalese. This is your host, Jack Wilenchek, on KFNX 1100 AM. For today's show, we'll be talking about, I guess it's a little bit in the news, the issue of domestic violence. You know, I mentioned to my secretary before I came on the show today that that's what we were talking about, and she said, "Well, no, that's not because of Jody Arias, is it?" And I said, "Well, you know, we'll try to steer it away from that subject because, of course, it's a very serious issue. The issue with Jody Arias is, of course, she's claiming that she doesn't deserve the death penalty because she's a victim of domestic violence. I don't know if you believe that or what, but I've got on the show here today, in studio with me here, Sarah Barrios, who is a local family law attorney. And I think we'll be joined later in the show as well by the director of the Arizona Coalition Against Domestic Violence. You know, let's just start the show here. First of all, Sarah, I want to thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me, Jack.
Absolutely. First question I want to put to you. Now, of course, you're a family law attorney. You have a lot of experience with domestic violence issues.
Unfortunately, that's true. I'm with the firm of Dickinson Wright Mariscal Weeks, and I do practice primarily in the area of family law. And domestic violence is an issue that comes up very frequently with respect to family law cases.
Yeah, as you say, unfortunately. And by the way, we were just joined, I'm very proud to say, by our other guest here, the director of the Arizona Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Sorry.
As I said, we're talking about domestic violence. Being the director of the Arizona Coalition Against Domestic Violence, obviously you've had some serious experience with this topic.
Mm-hmm. That's correct, yes. And actually, I just want to correct, I'm actually the deputy director. Our executive director was unavailable. So.
Yeah, go ahead and introduce yourself on the air.
Yes, so I'm Jesse Johnson. I'm the deputy director at the Arizona Coalition Against Domestic Violence.
Okay, great. I think where I want to take this is, what are some of the signs and symptoms of domestic violence? So, say you have a person in your family who you know, you expect to have this kind of relationship, you expect to have problems at home. What are some of the signs and symptoms that you need to look for?
One of the signs that we frequently look for in clients or in parties who are claiming to be victims of domestic violence are typically characteristics of hiding, either evidence of domestic violence or concerns that that person may have about their relationship. So, for instance, if a person is particularly secretive about the kinds of communications that they have with their spouse or a loved one, or, you know, the kinds of chats that they have with their children, or they're not willing to discipline their children, you know, if family members around or out in public, that can sometimes indicate that there may be a problem. If there are other indicators as well, such as, you know, marks on a person, frequent welfare checks by the police department to a particular home, and other things such as that.
Right, especially, you know, in that kind of scenario where it's an attorney-client relationship, if the person is being evasive, you know, there's definitely something majorly wrong because, of course, there's no reason to be evasive with your own attorney.
And that's true. And in some instances, you know, family attorneys are in a position where a particular relationship will be described to them, and they'll be in a position of saying, I understand that you may not be aware of this, but you may be a victim of domestic violence. Mm-hmm. But we're also in a position to be able to refer people out into the community to reach out and get some help. There are a lot of resources available for free, and, of course, there's always the National Domestic Violence Helpline, which is available 24 hours a day for folks who need to call in and chat about those issues.
You know, I do want to make sure, of course, the show, we get that information out. I think that's probably the most important thing we can do here in this hour that we have today. But Jesse Johnson here, director of the Arizona Coalition Against Domestic Violence, let me ask you that same question. What are some of the signs and symptoms that somebody might be in a situation of domestic abuse?
Well, I think for those of us that work sort of there or have worked in direct service, you know, we're obviously going to be looking for some different things than an attorney might. First and foremost, if somebody is saying that they believe they might be a victim of domestic violence, that's a good indication that something might be going on. There's things that can happen, like being isolated from family and friends, you know, when they typically have been able to go out and be with friends freely, but their partner now is, you know, well, he may not want me to do that or she may not want me to do that. So this element of control that we sort of look for that manifests in different ways.
Right. And that's even kind of a personality trait that I think you could spot in a potential abuser very early on, even before that kind of behavior starts.
Yes and no. I think that sometimes that behavior presents sort of romantically, and people think, oh, he just cares about me, or he's just being sweet, and he's concerned about me. So I think that it doesn't, you know, someone's
it's hard
not.
To pick up
it's
on
hard
it.
To pick up sometimes, and sometimes it it increases over time. So it's not something that just is out and blatant, you know, at the get-go, because if that were the case, most people wouldn't be staying in those types of relationships.
No, I know what you mean. It can be hard to distinguish that maybe from even just basic jealousy, or it's it can be very hard to see those very early warning signs and just in the person's personality is what you're telling me.
Yes.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of the, what I guess the question I have here is what are the stages of domestic violence? Let me ask your thoughts on that, Jesse.
We don't really look at domestic violence in terms of having stages.
You know, I thought that would be your answer. That's the question I have written down here for me. And even as I'm saying, I'm trying to think, well, what kind of stages would there be? I was hoping there may be some substantial answer to that, but go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think most people sort of associate domestic violence with the sort of cycle of abuse. That's a commonly what...
There you go. What is the cycle of abuse?
So the cycle of abuse is a tool that has been used in social services and in the, you know, in the movement of domestic violence for a long time. And it's sort of three phases, which is, you know, the honeymoon phase, the sort of tension building phase where someone might be sort of getting angry and their tension is building between the two partners. And then you have sort of the explosive phase. The coalition doesn't use that tool. We don't teach that tool to advocates who are in the field as much anymore.
Why is that?
For two primary reasons. One is when that tool is presented to survivors, people who identify themselves as survivors of domestic violence, most survivors don't say that that's not how their relationship worked, that there weren't three distinct phases in their relationship. Some survivors say, you know, there is no honeymoon phase. We're either tense and then there's an explosion. There's no apologies. There's no anything like that. So that tool doesn't resonate for
everybody.
Most survivors. Mm-hmm. The other part of it is it's sort of an outdated tool. It was done a long time ago, and it was done with 100 white women from an upper class demographic. And so when we're trying to, you know, teach advocates how to work with survivors across the spectrum, again, that tool just doesn't always work really well.
Now, that's a really interesting point. So your point is that that doesn't describe every situation where originally there is, you know, there are not signs, even to the victim of the abuse, and where that later shows up. You're saying that doesn't apply to every situation. A lot of situations, it is there from the start. It is tense even from the start.
Correct.
Yeah. Let me ask your thoughts on that too, Sarah. Have you seen that kind of spectrum of different, different kinds of domestic violence where it starts off? I guess as Jess referred to it, with the honeymoon phase and then turns into something else. Have you seen that, have you seen the other kind too, where it's there from the beginning?
Yes, I've seen both kinds, and it bears noting that that's one of the reasons why it's good for folks to move away from that cycle of abuse perspective, because there's not any mold that fits every domestic violence situation. Every relationship and its dynamics are going to be different because the folks in that relationship are different. And so that's something that people really should keep in mind. You know, it's not one gender or one particular type of person who can be a domestic violence survivor or an abuser. And in fact, even, one of the key things that we think about in terms of domestic violence, physical abuse, is not always present in a domestic violence case.
We should talk about that, yeah. All right, well, we're talking about domestic violence here on Legalese. I probably can't resist somehow tying this into the Jody Arias trial, so I will promise the audience to do that in the next segment. But my guests are Sarah Berrios, a local family law attorney, and Jesse Johnson, who's the deputy director, for the Arizona Coalition Against Domestic Violence. And you're listening to Jack Wilencheck on Legalese 1100, Independent Talk, KFNX. Welcome back to the show. This is Jack Wilencheck, and you're listening to Legalese on Independent Talk, 1100 KFNX. And, as I said before, we're talking about domestic violence. I cannot resist the urge to somehow tie this into the Jody Arias trial, since that's what everybody's listening to and talking about. Domestic violence, of course, is a very serious issue. I don't know if Jody Arias or whatever she's claiming is serious or not, but that's what we're talking about here today is the very serious issue of domestic violence. I have on the show Sarah Berrios, who's a local family law attorney, as well as Jesse Johnson, who's the deputy director of the Arizona Coalition Against Domestic Violence. And, you know, I want to make sure we get out at least a couple times during the show, the numbers, the call, that kind of thing. Jesse, can you do that for us?
Sure. Sarah mentioned the national hotline. It's 1-799-SAFE. And then the Arizona Coalition Against Domestic Violence actually has a lay legal advocacy hotline that's available Monday through Friday, and our phone number is 602-279-2900.
Great. All right. So we talked about a little bit about, you know, kind of the character of domestic violence. You guys made the very good point to me. I've never heard this before. That stereotype of domestic violence where it's, you know, like it doesn't show up immediately and where there's a honeymoon phase and it gets worse and worse, that doesn't describe everybody's situation, every victim's situation. In a lot of situations, it is tense and it's there from the get-go. And, you know, we talked a little bit about this, my next question, but I want to put to you guys anyway. And the question is, what is the profile of the typical abuser? I think we've talked about this a little bit. You know, I think your answer to this was that it's really hard to predict. I mean, there really isn't necessarily a profile for one. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's a true statement. I mean, certainly when we look at, you know, statistics, we love our research. I think the only maybe indicator that we could look to is that men who are exposed to violence as children or abused as children have a higher likelihood of becoming abusive to their partners in later life. But again, that doesn't apply to every situation. So it is just a matter of being aware, and there's just
no way to tell.
There's just no way to tell necessarily.
Yeah.
Well, and I think the same is true of women as well who become abusers, is that they often do have in their background some violence that's occurred within the family that they experienced either from prior relationships or as children. And I think that's very common among folks who are struggling in those situations.
Yeah, I'm sure that's. I mean, would you agree with that, Jesse? That tends to be present in these kinds of, you know, it's always been my general theory, my, you know, kind of armchair psychologist theory, that a lot of crime does have its origins in abuse, you know, in child abuse. I could go on about that, and you know, I think we've had the county attorney on the show before, who's given his own theories about kind of the origins of crime. But I could see that being absolutely a reason for. You know, in as much as it's reason for people to do bad things in general, it can be a reason for somebody to abuse their spouse, as if they themselves were abused or they witnessed that kind of abuse when they were a child. It's just a sad kind of cycle, but I have no trouble believing it. You know, another question I have for you guys is whether an abuser has any kind of psychological illness that's been defined. You know, my guess is that there's no particular psychological illness for it. It's just, you're shaking your head, Jesse.
No,
we'll be answer that question.
So, we rephrase it. We don't, you know, people are people, and survivors who talk about their partners who are abusive don't call them abusers. So we, you know, people who choose to be abusive are simply making a choice. So, I mean, if we want to put a mental health label on people who make choices, then I guess we're all in trouble, but, domestic violence is a choice. Yes, men who witness or experience violence when they're in childhood or throughout their relationships do have a higher likelihood. But the bottom line is there's an active choice to exert control over a partner. And I certainly know plenty of men in my life who experienced, you know, childhood abuse and have not made a choice to be abusive in their relationships.
Yeah. I like that. I mean, it's a very honest way of looking at it, as opposed to just classifying it as some kind of illness and these guys are criminals, and that it is a choice. And, you know, these guys make the wrong choice. I think everybody in their relationship, you know, knows when they're stepping over the line and where they're getting abusive and when to stop. These are guys who just, they don't stop and they feel they don't have to.
Right. And I think one thing to note is that these aren't people who tend to exhibit this type of behavior with other people in their life. So they don't necessarily go to work and get into an altercation with their boss over something. So there is a very calculated, you know, effort to exhibit that type of behavior on the person closest to them.
Only at home where they think nobody can see it.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really important point also for identifying those of our loved ones or friends who may be struggling with domestic violence. If you start to hear statements like, well, you don't really know how she's going to react, or I'm worried about what he's going to say when we get home. And it sounds out of place, that can sometimes indicate that the person who your loved one is dealing with behind closed doors is different than what that person presents to the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, as we were saying at the beginning of the show, there's those little signs and symptoms that you can look for. All right, well, let me ask you, you know, again, I think I just want to instinctively find some kind of predictor, some kind of way that even without, you know, letting it happen, that they can pick up on when there's a real domestic abuse kind of situation. So let me ask you guys this question. How often is substance abuse involved in a domestic violence situation? How often can it be tied into some kind of use of drugs or alcohol? Or how often does that happen? Is that usually a factor in domestic violence situations or not?
I don't think you could say it's usually factored in across all of the cases, but it is sometimes a crutch or an excuse that a person who is being abusive will use. For instance, they may say, well, you know how upset I get when I drink, but then they don't seek any assistance for a drinking problem that they may have. It's merely a crutch so that they can continue to make that choice of being abusive.
Mm-hmm. Now, again, I like that answer. That's again, it's really just the choice these guys make. There's nothing to rationalize it. I mean, it's just like committing a crime, you know. Crime isn't just generally, you know, associated with drug abuse. A lot of guys might use that as their excuse for committing a crime, stealing somebody's purse. They need the money for drugs. But in the end, they made the decision to steal that purse. Same kind of thing. You can't just, in a way, it's scary because, of course, you know, that you can't, like I say, predict it. You can't, you know, see if you know, there's a substance abuse problem in a relationship, you know, that there might be domestic violence going on there, too. You can't predict it. So on the one hand, it's scary, but on the other hand, that's the truth. This is a choice these guys make, and really the only way to stop them, I guess, you know, we'll spend some time talking about that. I don't know, is there any way to stop somebody who's a domestic abuser from doing it?
I mean, I think it's like with anybody, you know, people are going to stop doing something that's harmful to them or somebody they love because they choose to stop. So, you know, for example, somebody who may be, you know, a smoker, maybe well-intended to quit. And, you know, it's a struggle, and it's not to say it's not a process. I mean, it is a learned behavior, so you have to unlearn it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not something that I would say is easy for somebody who's choosing to be abusive to just turn off. But there are resources out there, and should somebody decide to make that change, they certainly are capable of doing that with support.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, no, it's the issue of if it's a crime, and how do you prevent anybody from doing a crime? You know, it's we could spend a whole show talking about that, but we'll stay on our subject for the show, which is actually domestic abuse. Again, my guests are Sarah Berrios, a local family law attorney, excuse me, tongue tied. And Jesse Johnson, Deputy Director of the Arizona Coalition against Domestic Violence. We've got just a couple minutes here before we take our half-hour break. You know, one of the things I want to just talk about here real quickly, is this issue worse than usual or better than usual? I mean, I want to say during a recession, during hard times, this issue probably gets a little worse.
For us at the Coalition, we work very closely with the residential programs across the state, and anecdotally, we were hearing that not the prevalence hadn't necessarily increased, but that the severity increased. So they were seeing survivors of violence who had experienced far more extreme physical abuse. Again, there's no sort of research or any numbers to sort of back that up. The prevalence of domestic violence doesn't change depending on sort of the economy, but
yeah,
the severity certainly can change depending on what might be going on in the individual relationships.
Well, and I think that there's definitely something to be said about how we look at problems that are widespread and pervasive in over years and throughout society. For instance, and you could say there are problems with immigration, going all the way back to the Irish immigrating into the United States, and the face of that immigration problem, for lack of a better word, has changed. So too with domestic violence. Now we're seeing more instances of domestic violence, you know, for people of all different backgrounds and
in different places than maybe you've seen before.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and no, and again, as we said, you know, it's a decision people make, so it's a decision that they always make. But I guess the point is, it can be worse in circumstances like these. All right, obviously, by the music, we got to go run through a break here. This is Jack Willen, Check Independent Talk, 1100 KFNX. Hey, welcome back to the show. This is Jack Willenchek, and you're listening to Legalese on Independent Talk, 1100 KFNX. And for today's show, we've been talking about domestic violence. And I'll confess, you know, my producer went on vacation today, and he may have had Jody Arias' trial in mind when he scheduled this show. In fact, I think we're going to do the show last week, and then we got bumped by a sports game. So, but it's still timely because, you know, she still hasn't been sentenced to death, to my knowledge. I probably should be listening to news breaks. But, you know, I cannot resist taking the show in that direction, if only for a minute. And, you know, I think probably the reason I want to resist it, as I was saying to you guys off the air, the reason I want to resist it is I think Jody Arias, to many people, is you know, the boy who cried wolf. She's somebody who is falsely claiming, many people believe, that she was a victim of domestic violence for her own purposes and evading the death penalty. You know, and of course, domestic violence is a very serious issue. And you know, there's a lot of people out there with serious domestic violence problems. I want to think Jody Arias is just kind of cheapening it. But, you know, let me ask you, Jesse Johnson, Deputy Director of the Arizona Coalition Against Domestic Violence. What's the position you guys have taken on this, on the Jody Arias debacle?
Well, I think that cases like the Jody Arias trial are cases that are, you know, what we call high profile, sort of good, bad, or indifferent, elevate the awareness of domestic violence, regardless of your opinion of Jody or the case or whatever. You know, from our perspective, you know, we track domestic violence-related deaths throughout the state every year, and 131 people lost their lives in domestic violence-related incidences in 2012. 1,700 people die across the country related to domestic violence every year. So to focus on one particular case for us doesn't do justice to the larger issue. But cases like this certainly do raise awareness, like I said, good, bad, or indifferent.
Yeah.
Well, and I think with respect to those questions that are running around in everybody's minds now, you know, was she a victim of domestic violence? I think that just reminds us that with respect to each individual case, the totality of the circumstances has to be taken into account. And at times, those circumstances aren't always out in the open. They're oftentimes behind closed doors. And that makes it very difficult without, you know, a really in-depth understanding of all of the facts and circumstances to determine if somebody's allegations of domestic violence are false or supported or, you know, legit in any way.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was Sarah Barrios, who's a local family law attorney. You know, Sarah, I know that the kinds of the situations that in which you encounter domestic violence would probably typically be in a divorce or a child custody, you know, case. And I think that's certainly a different scenario where people are making allegations of domestic violence in that kind of scenario. You know, I want to say there might be a potentially a higher possibility or higher fear of false claims in that kind of a scenario where again, kind of like in the Jody Arias situation, there is an ulterior motive. You know, would you agree with that? Is there a higher fear, at least in family law and in divorce cases, of false claims of domestic violence?
That's been my experience, that there are that issue and the question of whether or not allegations are supported or false, that does arise very frequently in family law cases. And that may be because there's a presumption in place and part of our statutes relating to custody, which we now call legal decision making, that if there has been a significant history of domestic violence, it's not in the best interest of parents to share joint custody of children who've been either abused themselves or have had the other parent abused. And so there is a motivation there, and I wouldn't say it doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm. But, of course, you know, in general, and you know, Jesse Johnson, Deputy Director of the Arizona Coalition Against Domestic Violence, you guys in the shelters, that's not the case. There are real problems out there, and I take it you don't have a serious fear of false claims.
We don't, based on what we've, you know, the research that we've seen and sort of the survivors that we've come across. You know, the statute does identify significant domestic violence, which would indicate that someone can't just walk into a courtroom and say, I'm a victim of domestic violence, and that would qualify under that statute. Typically, there's some sort of record, either police reports or someone's kept a journal. So it's not something that, certainly from our perspective, that we would see people just going into court claiming domestic violence, thinking it'll work to their benefit when they have to show that you know, that it did occur.
Yeah, there's real safeguards there.
Sure.
And, you know, Sarah, I think you were telling me off the air there's something going on in the legislature with this now. I think there was something recently passed on this subject, if you want to talk about that briefly. It was on the subject of false claims and for domestic violence.
In January, the legislature they had previously passed, and it became effective in January, Section 25415. It's that renumbered statute, and it specifically relates to, in family law cases, the sanctions that a judge can impose on a party who makes false allegations knowingly and intentionally. And those two words are very important. To knowingly and intentionally make false allegations means that there's a higher standard. It's not something you can do accidentally or even with less care than is necessary in that situation. And those two words were part of what's known as the Hobbs Amendment that was put into place in that statute before it was signed by the governor and passed into law. And I believe Jamie worked with the coalition and in terms of making sure that those words were in place and, along with them, additional protections for victims of domestic violence.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think probably the overarching point here with Jody Arias and also as we were talking about with domestic violence issues in, for example, divorce, or you said it's no longer called child custody. What's the term du jour? I don't do family law, so you have to educate me.
Basically, the nomenclature, the name that used to go by custody, is now in Arizona legal decision-making authority.
Legal decision-making authority.
And that kind of was because I think folks were confusing visitation or physical custody with the idea of making decisions for
legal
a child.
Custody.
Right. Although for the purposes of interpreting out-of-state or federal opinions, custody is still custody.
It's kind of like the difference between alimony and, of course, we call it spousal maintenance here. It's yeah, essentially the same thing.
Exactly.
All right. Appreciate you educating me on that point. What I was going to say was that the overarching point here is that, you know, there's a big difference between real cases and real problems with domestic violence and what you might see in the courts or what you might see spouting out of Jody Arias' mouth. You know, this is a real problem. And, you know, I think there is, as I say, a very strong sense of many people that she is an example of a rare example of somebody making false claims, which I think the point I'm trying to make is it may happen more often in a courtroom than it happens in the real world. In the real world, if somebody is coming to you or you start to suspect some domestic violence, you better act on it. Would you agree with that, Jamie, Jesse?
Yeah, I think certainly when, you know, when you have somebody who's gotten to a place where they can identify and say, I'm a victim, you know, I'm being victimized or I'm being abused, that I think it's in everybody's best interest to believe that person just like you would a child if they said they were being abused. But again, I think that, you know, there is research that indicates that false allegations, even in the courtroom, aren't as prevalent as some people
might think.
Yeah. Again, that's our perspective. And I
tend to agree. Certainly in the real world, I think there's the opposite problem where enough very real allegations, enough very real problems are not being brought up. And, you know, we're going to have to take a break here, last break of the show before going to our last segment. But in the last segment, I do want to talk about, you know, for people who are in that situation, some of the excuses that you typically hear, you know, some of the reasons why they say they won't do anything. And I know there are a lot of them. And just what, as a friend or family member, you can do about it. You know, I promised in the beginning of the show we'd throw out the numbers again to call for domestic violence issues. So, Jesse, if you'd be happy enough to do that.
Sure. The national hotline, I think you misspoke earlier, it's 1-800-799-SAFE. And then the Arizona Coalition Against Domestic Violence, 602-279-2900.
All All right, great. This is Jack Wilenchek on Independent Talk, Legalese, 1100 KFNX. All right, welcome back to the show. This is Jack Wilenchek on Legalese Independent Talk, 1100 KFNX. All right, the way we've talked about on the show today is domestic violence. As I said, I have tried my earthly best to steer the show away from the Jody Arias trial, which may or may not have been the reason my producer scheduled the show last week. And as I said, we had a sports game, so it got bumped to this week. But I think that is the main point to make there is that domestic violence should be distanced from the Jody Arias trial. People make a lot of claims in court that they're pressured to make, and I think there's a certain likelihood that false claims will be made in court that are not made in the real world, and that I think again the real world I think you have the opposite problem where people have real problems with domestic violence that they are not even talking about, much less making false claims about. So I think one very important thing I want to touch on here in the last segment of the show is where you do have an identified or an almost certain domestic violence issue, you know, whether it's a family member or whoever. When you talk to that person and you encourage them to do something, then you start hearing the excuses. So let's talk about that. What are some of the excuses then that people that you tend to hear when from somebody who's in a domestic violence situation as to why they can't get out of it?
So for us at the coalition, it's a real fear to leave a situation if you have somebody who's, you know, said if you do X, then I will do Y to you, and they have always followed through on those threats, and perhaps they're threatening somebody, you know, to harm or kill if they leave a situation, then they have every reason to believe that may happen. Women are at increased risk for physical assault when they leave a situation. A lot of the deaths, a lot of the homicides that you see on the evening news are, you know, related to what we call separation violence. Somebody has left the situation. The person who has been exercising control over that person has basically lost their control. So the ultimate act of control is to kill somebody. So there's very real fear about physical safety, but there's also, if there's economic reasons why somebody may or may not be able to leave a relationship, citizenship or immigration status may be tied to why a person feels like they can't leave a situation. So I think the bottom line is it's complicated and there's no one reason or any, you know, there's a laundry list of reasons why women are forced to stay.
I think that's true. I think a lot of it comes down to resources, you know, in terms of people. Are there folks who are going to be able to support a victim who decides to separate from a violent relationship? And financial resources, is that person going to be able to provide for him or herself? Often those patterns of control and isolation include isolation away from financial resources, so that a person who is in an abusive relationship will often feel as though they risk, you know, homelessness and an inability to care for themselves long-term because they have no choice in their mind but to continue relying on this other person in the relationship despite the abuse. I think sometimes, too, there's an excuse for folks who don't suffer physical abuse that because they haven't been hit or, you know, pushed, that they're not being abused, when in fact you can receive a good deal of verbal and emotional abuse that's long lasting and very detrimental to a person without ever having a finger lifted against them. And that's something that's very important for folks to remember. If you're asking yourself whether or not you're being hit, and the question isn't, how comfortable do I feel? How safe do I feel in this relationship, in my home? Then the question might not be the right question.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good point to make. And as you've been saying, the situation can just be that the abuser is extremely controlling. You have situations where he's, limits the person to, tells them they can't even leave the home, or they can only leave it for so many minutes, or you know, basically prevents them from getting a job and becoming self-sufficient. You know, I guess a big part of the reason why many people are reluctant to get out of this kind of a situation is, I mean, number one is the fear of retaliation, which was, Jesse, you were talking about. And then a lot of the other reasons, it seems to me, are just kind of general separation anxiety kind of reasons, you know, which you might see in any kind of a separation case or divorce case, concerns about being self-sufficient, or even concerns about, you know, if they have a child together, what's going to happen to the child. Those kind of things. And so I guess the question I want to put to you guys is, well, how do you deal with these concerns, you know, to the person that you're trying to help who's telling you these kinds of things, that they're worried that, that you know, what's going to happen to the child, that they won't find a job, or that he's going to, you know, he knows where they live or where she's going to go. What do you tell that person? How do you help them?
I think it's important to empower a person with the ability to make their own choice and not to bully or harass a loved one into making a decision before they're ready. And, you know, and starting slow, saying things like, I'm here for you if you ever need to talk. Or, you know, I would be happy to have you stay with me if you ever needed a place. Those kinds of things can, you know, kind of lay the groundwork for hope in a person who may be afraid to plan or may be afraid to broach the subject with their loved ones or with their friends and family members. And that usually is something that we all can do, you know, in our, you know, our dealings with people who may or may not be experiencing domestic violence.
So your advice is to take something of an indirect approach. But what if, you know, you start to worry? I mean, what if you don't want to get too late? You know, you don't want them to be in that situation for so long. You don't want to be too you know, implicit with it. You don't want to be too subtle with it. What can you do when you've been doing that for a long time, and you know there's still a problem, and you know they're still afraid to do something about it?
Well, I can't emphasize this enough. If a person feels as though their well-being and safety, or the well-being and safety of folks in their household, is jeopardized, it's very important to get help right away. Call 911. And it may be that there are folks who are put into a position of having to ask the police to check in on the welfare of a loved one's home. You know, if you and I, you know, Jack, were related, and I ended up saying to you at the end of an evening, you know, I'm running late from dinner. When I get home, my husband's going to kill me. I mean, you may see on my face that I'm serious. I'm seriously afraid to go home. Maybe that means that you call me and you check in on me, but maybe it means that you ask, you know, the local officers to go by and just do a welfare check. It's a really dicey proposition, though, mm-hmm. because on the other hand, you don't, if you're seeing that situation, you don't want to make it worse. Exactly.
Right.
And sometimes that reaching out for help and breaking a grasp of an abuser's control can cause them to retaliate.
Mm-hmm. You know, I what I almost want to hear here is some kind of, I guess you can always encourage them to call the number that we gave out before. And let's go ahead and give it out one more time real quick.
Sure. The national hotline is 1-800-799-SAFE, S-A-F-E, and then the coalition is 602-279-2900.
You can always, you know, encourage them, I guess, to get in touch with somebody like you guys, the Arizona Coalition Against Domestic Violence. And I'm sure you have, of course, that's what a shelter. Why don't you talk about just the general process there of you know, if I encourage a person I know is in a bad situation to talk to you guys, mm-hmm. what happens after that?
So real quickly, our hotline will talk to friends, family, survivors, and we have advocates who are available to do safety planning. And although I agree with what Sarah's saying, I think the most important thing is to understand that we call them survivors for a reason, because they are literally surviving a situation and they know how to do it. They are the experts in their lives. So to ask them, is it okay? You know, if I'm concerned, if you tell me that he's going to kill you, it makes me want to call the police. What will happen to you if police show up? I mean, again, it could be a worse scenario. So I think just asking the questions and making sure that your responses are really in the best interest of the survivor, because we all think what we know is best, you know, calling police, telling a person to leave, when really it's what's best for you. And, you know, why is she staying? Well, why is he doing this? And I think once we start putting the onus on the person who's making those choices, instead of making the survivor responsible for keeping herself safe and leaving the situation. Why is this person abusing you, and start shifting responsibility.
Mm-hmm. So, and you know, we've only got a couple minutes here before we have to close out the show, but so when somebody's in that situation and they get in touch with the hotline, I'd like to know what then happens. You know, they get in touch with the hotline. Where does it go from there?
Sure. So our hotline is 100% confidential. They'll be connected to one of the advocates who can walk them through safety planning, how to get an order of protection, what a, you know, family court case might look like. And of course, they're available, you know, so a person can call back repeatedly if they need information as they sort of go through the process. So it really is just to provide information and support in a way that's in their best interest.
Yeah, basically help them with the legal process somewhat.
Right.
That's good. Are you affiliated with shelters in Arizona?
Shelter programs are our memberships. So the work that we do helps them serve survivors in a better way.
All right. Well, if somebody wants to get more information on your organization, where can they go?
They can go to our website at www.azcadv.org or call us at 602-279-2900.
All right, great. That's Jesse Johnson, Deputy Director of the Arizona Coalition Against Domestic Violence. I want to thank my other guest in the studio here, Sarah Barrios, a local family law attorney. Guys, thanks so much for coming on the show. And this is Jack Wilenchek on Legalese Independent Talk, 1100 KFNX.